Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
It's great to see you. How many of you are here for the first time?
Oh, wonderful.
Great. Oh, I hope you have fun. This is the first day, and it's just, you have such an amazing set of things to look forward to. So I hope you'll all enjoy yourselves very much, and that nobody on this panel drops their sentences at the end. We'll do our best. Give us a shout out if we've got a problem. I have to give you a quick bit of housekeeping. Remind you all have to turn down the volume or on your cell phones. My name is Jane Chubbatore, by the way. I'm your moderator. I am sort of local. I'm a Stanford graduate, and I spend my time partly in Sonoma County, where we have had a lot of wildfires and flooding, and part of my time in Brooklyn, where we have other kinds of exciting events. I'm really honored to be moderating this panel because it's called Critics' Choice. And I am, in fact, in addition to being a story writer, a critic. I write a weekly column for Lit Hub, and I write a monthly column for BBC Culture. And I'm always reading. I have a garage full of books and an office full of books and an office closet full of books. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. I want to thank all of the many sponsors, individuals, and organizations that make the Bay Area Book Festival work. I mean, it's something that's a labor of love for a lot of people, but it also requires a lot of donations, and we're really grateful that those people are giving these donations. I'm going to have the speakers talk to you in a minute, but first I want to tell you just briefly about what it feels like to open a book that comes into my office. I have, for some reason, the ability to anticipate with hope any new book that's coming out. And I do have hundreds of books come to me every month. And I read hundreds of books a year. I have always kept in my mind that I want to be open to all possibilities, because there's always talent out there, you never know. So I open every book and I read several pages. Sometimes that's enough for me to understand I don't like the voice, right? It just don't connect to it. But other times I have like three dozen books I have to boil down to 10 that I love. So I'm really honored today because I have the opportunity to talk to new authors. And one of the excitements of being a critic is that you get to see the writing from new people that you've never read before. And there's a special anticipation to that because you go, oh, it starts out and it's good. And then you go, wow, this is really exciting because it's a new person you've never read before. So there's some kind of new frisson. How many in this audience have read these three authors? Oh, good. Because I was going to say, we have kind of an interesting staggering of time zones here. I read Reese's book in 2017, and I included it in my BBC column that says books to read in 2018, which came out in January of that year. And her book came out what month, Reese?
In July.
In July. So I read it so far in advance, I couldn't talk to anybody about it. You know, I would tell my darling, oh, this is really an amazing book, but it took a while to be able to discuss it. I read Namwali's book in last fall. And I put it into my 2019 books to read. And what was your pub date, Namwali?
March 26th of
March. Okay. So I wrote about it in January. And once again, it's literally, you got to read this book, but wait, soon you will hear about it. And Jamel, it was coming along. And he's getting like National Book Award nominations, and he's a finalist for the John Leonard Award. And these are some of the biggest awards in the literary world. And so I pick up the book, and it's just remarkable. So it's just exciting to know that we have these three authors with us in the Bay Area at the moment. Who knows where they will end up, because life is funny for the literary world. I want them to introduce themselves briefly by saying who they are and answering a question that I have given them in advance. I'm going to go alphabetically. And the question is, what was the process like for you while writing the book? How long did it take? How many drafts leading up to the point where you were preparing to launch the book? Each of them, first Jamal.
Thank you. Is this okay? Cool. Thanks so much for being here, everyone. My name is Jamel Brinkley, and I'm the author of A Lucky Man, which is a short story collection. So to answer your question, Jane, I worked on the stories in this collection for about 4 or 5 years, between 2011 or 12 and 2015 is when I drafted the stories. I spent a year revising all of them on my own. And then I spent another year revising all of them with my editors at Grey Wolf. So you're looking at 6 to 7 years of time working on this book. And because they're stories, it's difficult to say how many drafts I wrote. Each of them had lots of drafts. I guess I just want to emphasize that it was a long time. Sometimes I speak to high school audiences and I tell them it took 6 years and they all gasp and say they never want to be writers. But that's what I did.
Do you want us to go in?
Reese, okay. Because we're going alphabetical.
We're seated in first name alphabetical, but you mean last name.
I'm going alphabetical. Okay. Sorry. That's so old school.
So my book took, so I'm Aro Kwan. I wrote this book, The Incendiaries, and I also go by Reese. So I worked on this book for 10 years, which always, I started measuring my life by Thanksgivings at some point. Because at first, you know, bless their hearts, my family has been very supportive. They were so excited I wanted to be a writer. And so right around for the first 3 years, they were just like, so when's that book going to be finished? When do we get to buy it at the bookstore? And I just feel like, you know, it's going to be a while. I don't think I'm a very fast writer. Around the 5-6 year mark, people started asking with like great nervousness. You could see the sort of like building up to the difficult question to ask the difficult family member at Thanksgiving. And they'd just be like, so how's the book? How's that going? Are you? And then, At roughly around the 8 year mark, I realized it was getting very bad because they stopped asking me. They would wait until I had left the table to get like seconds of cranberry sauce, and they would lean in and ask my husband very quietly, "How's Reese? Is she all right? How's her writing?" As though I were dying in the next room, and he could only talk about me in whispers. So yeah, it took 10 years. I have no idea, to answer your question about drafts. I honestly have no idea how many drafts it's gone through. It could be 30, it could be 60. I think I truly don't want to know, because I don't want to know what it's going to take for me to finish my second novel, which I'm already 3 years into, and which still feels like a chaotic mess.
I have you both beat. I started this novel, The Old Drift, my name is Namwali, in the year 2000. And I wrote it off and on for 15 years while I was also getting a PhD, writing a dissertation, turning that dissertation into an academic book, getting my job at Berkeley just up the road, getting tenure with that book, and also writing another novel, which is currently in a drawer. This book I wrote about a scattered third of over the course of those 15 years, and then sold the book based on a partial, and then wrote the remaining two-thirds of the book in a year and a half. So I don't really know how long it takes for me to write a book. In terms of drafts, I'm not going to count the 15-year process, because some of those pieces got published as short stories, and those would go through multiple revisions with editors. Others were just on my hard drive, just kind of waiting to be awoken like some kind of zombies. And so I'll just count the draft, the first full draft after that year and a half, which I submitted to my editors in the spring of 2017. I then had another full draft after their edits, and then I'd say two more I would count as drafts insofar as it was going through copy edits and then through proofreading. But honestly, even though the book is out and has substance and weight, it still feels like a draft to me. Like, I still revise as I'm reading out loud to audiences. It's so bad. And yesterday, as someone came up to me and they had found a typo, and I was like, oh, gasp. So I'm like currently drafting an email to my editors being like, so I can like change it still, right? Like completely, like I can make it like a third of the size, and like, so we'll see what comes of that. Probably I'll get to adapt it into some sort of, you know, form at some point, or maybe publish it as a trilogy or something. I would love that. Producers, directors in the audience, talk to me afterwards.
Yeah. We could start now. So we have three amazing authors, and I'm going to ask each of them to read a little bit. And I wanted to just give you a quick sense of my reactions to them early on. When I read Jamel's work, I felt like each of the stories brought me into a universe. They're complete stories. His work has been compared to Alice Munro's and John Edgar Wideman's. And I agree. I think those are good comparisons. You find yourself in each story. I mean, the opening story, you're crashing at a party in Brooklyn, and you go through the night, and it's just, you're there, and you feel what everyone is feeling in the room. So that's an exciting book. Reese's book has this amazing approach to a novel form in that it's through the point of view of three different people who have very different ways of expressing themselves. And one of them is a kind of a cult leader who's been kind of had a horrifying experience in North Korea. Another is a woman who was a gifted pianist. And another is a man who loves that woman and therefore gets to know about the cult. So you get drawn in through the three different voices. Now, Molly's book is a combination of things, and I love the chorus of voices that is this mosquitoes who become, they start out as mosquitoes along the waterfall where, you know, the classic tale of Stanley and Livingston discovering this place. And by the end of the book, they are drone mosquitoes. So that's just a piece of it. Then you have all these historic elements. You have Afrofuturism. You have so many different genres. So it's the three of them write in very different ways, and each of them is exquisite in each of their own ways. So I'm going to let us listen for a little bit. Jamel.
Okay, so like Namwali, I also revise my supposedly finished book. and I'm going to read a revised excerpt from the title story, A Lucky Man. Back at the security desk, it didn't take long for James to ask about Alexis. He made no secret about his fondness for Lincoln's wife, and she inspired many of his jokes. He said her first name in a familiar way, almost lewdly. Though she was 46, 10 years older than James, she could have passed for his age or younger. Unlike Lincoln, she had kept her looks. She liked to say, "Black don't crack." When James joked, she was the inspiration, and Lincoln was the target. "I'm just jealous as all, Chief, you know that," James said. "You're a lucky man. I wish I could get me a high quality woman like that. A good woman." When Lincoln met Alexis years earlier, they were equals. He was as handsome as she was beautiful and bright, and he had as much to expect from the coming years as she did. Lincoln courted her with a passion rooted in his certainty about himself. He had been a good student and had excelled at boxing and football. His life had been full of prizes, trophies, and scholarships. He had had more than his share of attention from women and had enjoyed the warmth and cheer of many men. He thought often about the question of what lay ahead in his life, but when he tried to see its exact outlines, he couldn't. It was indistinct with light. It had been this way with her, too. At Garfield's bar, he would tell his buddies how it hurt to look at her, and they would agree, mistaking his words for their usual hyperbole about women. On one of those nights at Garfield's, it occurred to him, briefly, that love was pain. When he was engaged to Alexis, his friends would tell him how lucky he was, but this was said as a joke. Lincoln would say thank you and agree, would tell them how grateful he was for her, but this wasn't true. He deserved her. This was what he believed, and he knew this was what his friends believed in. A man of a kind should get what he deserves, and if a man like him couldn't get a woman like her, then something was terribly wrong with the world. Do her friends tell her she's lucky, Lincoln wondered. Has her mother told her to give thanks for her man? She might be saying it now as they picked out plums and nectarines at the fruit market, or sat out on the porch shelling peas. But surely this was foolish thinking, just as foolish as thinking their daughter, Tamika, would spend these years breaking the hearts of any eager college boy who wasn't like her father. Lincoln came to understand that this too had always been part of his vision for himself, to have children who adored him, a son who resembled and worshipped him, a daughter for whom no other man would ever measure up. This was part of what he couldn't see before he married. But there was no son, and the years of their daughter's life had marked his decline. She had grown up watching it. His professional gambles with the boxing gyms and the attempts at training and managing had failed. Now his charm and stature no longer earned him opportunities, and in New York he had no reputation. He was lucky, he knew, to have his job, steady and respectable work, but years ago he and his wife had deserved each other. Time had not treated them equally. Why did he expect otherwise, though? With any two people, one would get the brunt of it, and time had hit him worse than any beating he'd ever seen in the ring. He felt it had brutalized him. But one day his wife's looks would go. Creases would line her face, the skin there would loosen and thin, pouches would form under her eyes. And her mind, it would start to slip and show weakness, too. Everything cracks eventually. But when? How long would it be his good fortune to have her? How long until he could just plain have her again? Her smooth face. Even after all these years, he longed for it, to rub his cheek against hers and breathe hot words into her hair. There had been no diminishment of that feeling. Yet he also felt the urge to press the sharps of his teeth against her face, to bite down and place the first deep crack in it. But Lincoln was a man with luck. Yes, he still had it. People said so, and they were probably right. Good fortune can change in an instant, however, or it might never. But whatever it does has nothing to do with you. For years it had persisted in following him. It went home from work with him, lived with his family, claimed a space between him and his wife in their bed. She still had her light, but his was his luck. If it left him, she would too. No one would blame her. Not her friends, not her mother, not their daughter, not even James. Maybe Lincoln's luck had already abandoned him. His wife was gone for now, after all. Or maybe Lincoln was the one with wrong notions. Maybe, slumped in the chair at his desk, unable to muster the little strength it took to hold in his belly, it was his luck that he was alone with. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamil. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions before we move on. I love that line, time had not treated them equally, and the idea of the cracking and the changes in a marriage situation. And I'm wondering about this universe you create in this story and in your collection. To what extent does it come from your own life and people you know or people you've seen? What part is research? What part is influenced perhaps by role models you might have had as a writer? In a sense, it's that awful question, where does it come from? We know when it comes from your own genius and your own imagination.
Thanks for the question. I think it varies from story to story. With that story in particular, A Lucky Man, it comes from, the root of it is an experience I had. I taught high school English for a few years in New York, at kind of a fancy private school. Don't say thank you. So I taught at this school, and you know, with any kind of institution, certain people kind of rise up as kind of the main characters of the place. And one of the things I noticed about teaching at the school were sort of the people who weren't the administrators or the students or the teachers. The people who in many ways make the school run, though. So thinking of the cafeteria workers, the janitors, the security guards. And so the main character of this story is the security guard. And it just seemed to me that it's very easy, and I noticed this among the students and some of the teachers, it's very easy to sort of walk by these people and not notice them, you know, to sort of presume that they don't have full lives. So the root of this story was sort of, you know, thinking about someone like a security guard at a school and kind of imagining the fullness of his life.
Thank you. Reese, I keep doing this, but is it okay, guys?
Yes.
Just checking. Okay. Read us a little bit.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. So I'll just give you a quick... So what I usually tell people that the book is about is that it's about a woman who gets involved with a group of fundamentalist Christians. It turns out to be a cult with ties to North Korea, and they end up bombing abortion clinics, healthcare clinics, in the name of faith. I used to, like, I can always feel my face trying to do it again. I used to sort of smile very widely at people when I told people this, especially people I had just met for the first time at, you know, like at a dinner party when people ask, what do? I write, and I say, what's your book about? And I tell them, and I think I just was trying to convey that I'm not that weird. And then a friend did me the great kindness eventually of saying, Reese, it's so much weirder that you smile. Just keep a straight face when you deliver it. So I've been working on that. but so as Jane said, it's narrated by three different characters. And I'll just read from two of them. So the two I'll read from are John Leal, the cult leader, and Will Kendall, who loves this woman, Phoebe Lynn, who becomes involved with the cult, and he's very opposed to the cult and much of what it represents. And I'll read first from Will's and then from John Leal's sections. One, Will. They'd have gathered on a rooftop in Knoxhurst to watch the explosion. Platt Hall, I think, 11 floors up. I know his ego, and he'd have picked the tallest point he could. So often, I've imagined how they felt, waiting. With 6 minutes left, the slant light of dusk reddened the high old spires of the college, the level gables of its surrounding town. They poured festive wine into big-bellied glasses. Handshaking, they laughed. She would sit apart from this reveling group, cross-legged on the roof's west ledge. 3 minutes to go. Two. One. The Phipps building fell. Smoke plumed the breath of God. Silence followed, then the group's shouts of triumph. Wine glasses clashed together, flashing martial light. He sang the first bars of a Cheja psalm,
Others soon joined in. Carolyn bells chimed, distant birds blowing white, strewn, like dandelion tufts, an outsized wish. It must have been then that John Leal came to her side. In his bare feet, he closed his arm around her shoulders. She flinched, looking up at him. I can imagine how he'd have tightened his hold, telling her she'd done well, though before long, it would be time to act again, to do a little more. But this is where I start having trouble, Phoebe. Buildings fell. People died. You once told me I hadn't even tried to understand. So here I am, trying. 2. John Leal. Once John Leal left Knoxhurst, halfway through his last term of college, he drifted until he ended up in Yenji, China. In this city, adjacent to North Korea, he began working with an activist group that smuggled Korean refugees toward asylum in Seoul. He had found his life's work, he thought. Instead, he was kidnapped by North Korean agents, spirited across the border, and thrown into a prison camp outside of Pyongyang. In the stories he later told the group, he said the gulag brutalities were bad enough, but at least they'd been expected. What astonished him was the allegiance his fellow inmates showed toward the lunatic despot whose policies had installed them in their cells. They'd been jailed because, oh, they'd splashed a drop of tea on his newsprint portrait. A neighbor claimed to have overheard them whistling a South Korean pop song. Punished for absurdities, they still maintained that the beloved sovereign, a divine being, couldn't be to blame. At first, he assumed this was lip service, the prisoners afraid to say otherwise. But then, he thought of the refugees he'd met in Yenji, how they talked of loving the god they'd fled. They attributed the regime's troubles to anyone but the sole person in charge. A month into John Leal's time in the gulag, prison guards held an optional foot race, the prize a framed icon of the despot. In the confusion, those who fell were trampled. One child died of a broken spine. Through howls of pain, he shouted hosannas for his lord. They weren't lying, the poor fools. They believed in the man as one might believe in Jesus Christ. Some people needed leading. In or out of the gulag, they craved faith. But think if the tyrant had been as upright as his disciples trusted him to be. The heights he'd have achieved if he loved them. If, John Leal thought, until his idea began. Thank you so much.
Reese, you take us inside a North Korean prisoner camp. You take us inside a fundamentalist cult as it builds. You take us inside a university campus. You give us 3 points of view, Phoebe, Will, and John Leal. And you weave them together in this exquisite way. And what you're dealing with is the kinds of violence that we face around ourselves in this country and elsewhere. I'm curious about what kind of research was involved in working on this book. Did you travel to some of the places? Did you know them already? And what drew you to working in this material?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. For a little while, I did so much research. I read everything I could find. There were categories of research. I read everything I could find about the history of reproductive rights, of abortion rights in the U.S., about extremist groups, about cults, about sort of radical terrorist groups in general. I did research into North Korea and that was actually a lot less because I didn't start because I thought, hey, I want to like
have some North Korea in my novel. That wasn't really the objective. I have a distant family who fled what is now North Korea before the start of the Korean War, back when it was all just one Korea. And so I think at some point I just became very curious about this, because what that of course means is that if I have distant family that fled, that means that there's more distant family that didn't flee that stayed. And I'm presumably never going to meet them or know anything about them. And so I just started reading everything I could find about North Korea, out of a longing for something that I just knew nothing about. And, so that was one part where I never wanted people to walk away from this book thinking like, yeah, like I know so much about North Korea now. It's a novel, of course, but I wanted very much to show that lack of knowledge itself. I wanted to show that uncertainty in itself, and to sort of dwell in that was really important to me, because the responsibilities in writing about a place like that, they're so different than writing about like Toronto, right? If I said something wild about Toronto, just like, it's a law in Toronto that everyone has to have purple hair, people would just be like, no, that's not true. I've been to Toronto. we could talk to people in Toronto and it's not true. But I could say that about a village in North Korea and nobody would be able to, people wouldn't really be able to refute me. So their responsibilities felt just wildly different. And in terms of how I have it myself, visited North Korea. I went to a college in the Northeast that bled a lot into my representation of a university in this book. And I think I was very fascinated with the university, both in my own experience, but also with this book, by just like the ways in which class becomes so visible the minute you go to college. And especially at a sort of like Northeast elite college, there were so many ways in which I hadn't realized that relative to the people there that I had been disadvantaged. I hadn't even known until I went to college. And until I started coming across people who are like, whose family's buildings are on the, whose family's names are on the buildings, who are like sixth generation college students there. It just was so strange to me. And I think I was interested in that and in looking at that with the book. Play sounds so fun. I worked with the, sometimes it was play, but I ended up wanting these three different characters because I really wanted to depict sort of varieties of experiences of faith. And I grew up so religious that I was going to, my entire life plan for a little while was to become like a pastor or a missionary. I was extremely devout. I was going to like hide in a cave or something. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, but I was really excited about it. But then I lost my faith when I was 17, and it was cataclysmic in ways that I still have trouble talking about, because it was so hard, to lose this God who I believed in and loved. But it was also hard to lose my entire community, because my friends and family at the time were pretty much all deeply religious. Then there was this weird new next level of loneliness in which I couldn't find my experience in books. And you know, as like a bookish introverted teenager, I was used to feeling like wildly misunderstood by the world around me, but I was also used to finding companionship in books. And I couldn't this time. And then I went off to college, and all of my new friends, like they at most were, you know, like had gone to Easter twice with a grandparent, or they're like, well, I'm like culturally Jewish, I'm not religiously Jewish. And so I would just tell people at some point, like, yeah, so I was so religious, I thought I was going to be a pastor. And everyone would just look at me like, that's weird. And then they'd be like, well, you know, good for you. You're free. You can drink and have sex like the rest of us. You broke out. And I would just say like, well, you know, I guess that's true. But it's also this terrible grief that wasn't even legible to anyone around me. It wasn't legible as a grief. And so I wanted to write about that. And I wanted to write a book that could talk about these varieties of belief and of disbelief. And that could maybe make sense of what it is to believe or not believe to other people who are on a different part of that faith spectrum. So.
Thank you. Now, Molly, how many pages is your book?
Oh, 563.
I can't tell you the number of universes that you create in those pages. It's remarkable. And the number of genres that you use to tell the story that you tell that spans a century or two or one and a half centuries or two centuries or hard to say. But it's fascinating, and you're in the world of three different kinds of families, and you're surprising. To me, it's a little bit playful because the immigrants that you're seeing in these stories are not what you think they're going to be, given the kind of the usual, and I love it because it's kind of a little bit in your face, but it's not done in the way that I think it's trying to be in your face. But it says, there's a huge world that you guys don't know about, and I'm going to tell you, and you tell it so well. I'm curious about the levels of research, the levels of what you know, and the genre choices, because they are now what is becoming a new way of writing, which I guess one could call hybrid literature. But it's giving us stories in many forms in the same book, and I personally love that. So tell us a little bit about that research and how you put it all together.
Would you like me to?
Oh, but read first. Sorry. I'm jumping in here. Sorry about that. I'm so excited. I want to hear about this. What are you going to read for us?
The only thing I'll say to preface this is that when I started writing the novel in college, me and my friends would joke that this was the great Zambian novel you didn't know you were waiting for. And I tell the story of my country through, as Jane mentioned, three families over the course of multiple generations. And it's also told in multiple genres and multiple Englishes, multiple languages. I speak two Englishes. One is the accent that I'm speaking to you in now, and the other is what I call my Zinglish accent, and that's what this book is narrated in when I hear it in my head. So prepare yourself. Z. 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 And so, a dead white man grows bearded and lost in the blinding heart of Africa. With his rooting and roving, his stops and starts, he becomes our father unwitting, our inadvertent pater muzungu. This is the story of a nation, not a kingdom or a people, so it begins, of course, with a white man. Once upon a time, a goodly Scottish doctor caught a notion to find the source of the Nile. He found instead a gash in the ground full of massed tumbling water. His bearers called it Mosiotunya, which means the smoke that thunders, but he gave it the name of his queen, Victoria Falls. He described the falls with a stately awe, comparing the flung water to British things, to fleece and snow and the sparks from burning steel, to myriads of small comets rushing on in one direction, each of which left behind its nucleus rays of foam. He speculated that angels had gazed down upon it and said to each other, "How lovely." He even opined, like a set designer, that there really ought to be mountains in the backdrop. Adventure, disaster, fame, commerce, Christianity, civilization. He was mauled by a lion that shook him in its jaws, he said, as a dog shakes a rat. His wife died of fever. His beloved poodle drowned. He voyaged over land and along endless waterways. He freed slaves as he went, broke their chains with his very hands, and took them on as his servants and bearers. Late in his life, he witnessed a massacre, slave traders shooting at people in a lake, so many the canoes could not pass. He despaired. He was broken, broke. Queen Victoria had forgotten him. The royal geographers said he was dead. Then a mercenary Welsh bastard named Stanley, presumed, shook his hand and sent word to London. And in an instant, he was infamous, as if risen from the grave. Yet he refused to return to Merry England. Doddering, he drove deeper into the continent instead, still seeking his beloved Nile. Oh, Father Muzungu, the word means white man, but it describes not the skin, but a tendency. A Muzungu is one who will zunguluka, wander aimlessly, until they end up in circles. And so our movious Muzungu pitched up here again, dragging his black bearers with him. His medicine box went missing. Who took it? They never found out. And with it, his precious quinine. Fever hunted him and finally caught him. He died in a hut, in the night, on his bed, kneeling, his head in his hands. His men disemboweled him, planted his heart under a tree, and bore his corpse to the coast. A ship called the HMS Vulture took his body home. What was left without the living was buried under stone in the nave of Westminster Abbey. His people recognized him by the scrapes of the lion's teeth on his humerus bone. Such wonder at the resolve of his bearers to travel with a corpse for months on end, suffering loss and injury, sickness and battle, through blistering heat and blundering rain, beating off the taboo that to carry death is to beckon it, to come all the way to England to face interrogation, to build a model of the hut that he died in. What faith, what love, no, what fear. That corpse, that body was proof. Without it, who would possibly have taken their word that a white man among savages had died of bad luck, a mere fever? Men never believe chance can wreak great consequence, yet the story of this place is full of such slips. Error, noun, from the Latin, errare, to stray or to veer or to wander. For instance, the Wazungu who carved this territory into a colony, then a protectorate, then a federation, then a country, came here only because Livingston did. They drifted in and settled the land. They drew their arbitrary lines in the sand. They stole treaties from chiefs with a devious ruse, a royal charter meant for business but used for state. Waving flags and guns and beads to trade with, they scrambled rabbit for Africa and claimed it was Livingston's legacy. Neither Oriental nor Occidental, but accidental, is this nation. Would you believe our godly Scotch doc was searching for the Nile in the wrong spot? As it turns out, there are two Niles, one blue, one white, which means two sources, and neither of them is anywhere near here. This sort of thing happens with nations and tales and humans and signs. You go hunting for a source, some original word or symbol, and suddenly the path splits, cleaved by apostrophe or dash. The tongue forks, speaks in two ways, which in turn fork and fork into a chaos of capillarity. Where you sought an origin, you find a vast babble, which is also a silence, a chasm of smoke, thundering. Blind mouth.
So forgive me for stepping on your brilliant lines.
That's okay. So the question has to do with the research and all the different things that went into your 500x pages. It began with that prelude. It's just amazing. Go ahead.
So there are many, many different kinds of research I had to do for this book because it tells the story of Italian, Indian, and British migrants to Zambia. It also tells a story of Zambian history from its beginnings as a colonial settlement on the banks of the Zambezi River. That settlement was called the Old Drift. So a drift is the narrowest and stillest part of a river where you can drift things across. And an outpost kind of sprung up from that. And so the research that I did, for example, on that colonial settlement entailed reading a lot of historical documents gathered actually mostly online from Livingston tourism books and also a book called The Autobiography of an Old Drifter, which became the basis for the first chapter to follow this mosquito introduction, which is called The Falls, and tells the story of a British photographer named Percy Clark who came to the Old Drift to make his fortunes in the late 19th century. And found there, people from Germany, people from Holland, people from in Italy, an Italian hotelier named Pietro Gavuzzi, who became one of the other patriarchs of the families in the novel, and even a barman from Chicago who was the bouncer at the first Victoria Falls Hotel, and also Native Africans from the region, from many, many different tribes, including the Lea, who probably are the origin of the name Mosiotunya, which I just translated for you as the smoke that thunders, the Tonga, the Bemba. And one man that Percy mentioned in his book was a man named Ngulube, who Percy accidentally shot. Percy's a very blithe and racist person. And reading his autobiography, I decided to take Ngulube, Pietro Gavuzzi, the Italian hotelier, and Percy, and make them into the kind of great-grandfathers of these three families. So the research there involved a lot of reading, but I also learned about the Old Drift because I was home visiting and went to the Victoria Falls Game Park, and they pulled into this little grove and they're like, this is the Old Drift Cemetery. So there are these tumble down gravestones of, you know, I think 17 people of the about 200 that lived there, because everyone died of malaria at the Old Drift. So disease is also a big part of the novel. I did a lot of research on entomology, but also epidemiology of various diseases, including HIV/AIDS. And because the novel eventually goes all the way into a near future Zambia, where the final descendants of these three families are locked in a love triangle, but are also trying to start a political revolution, I had to do a lot of research on drones and engineering. And I also invented these beads that are chipped into people's hands. So it was a lot of science research as well. So yeah, the research was kind of all over the place. Archival research. Yeah.
Archival research primarily. And are there personal elements as well?
Well, so I'm Zambian. I'm mixed race. My father's British. My mother's Zambian. My father is now a Zambian citizen. So there's a little bit of a trace of him in my character, Agnes, who comes from England to Zambia right at the turn of independence and marries a black Zambian and becomes a Zambian citizen. But they're very different people, right? So there are elements of my family history in that way, but no one really maps onto someone autobiographical in my life, I would say.
And no drone mosquitoes you haven't encountered yet.
No. But I am obsessed with bugs, and I have been for a long time.
How long?
Oh, I mean, since I was a kid. I was almost a microbiology major in college. I've always been interested in biology in general, but I just find bugs really beautiful. I don't know.
Do you have favorites?
Moths and mosquitoes, yeah, I think. Just in terms of their anatomy and what they do.
Have you seen Luna moths? Has anybody seen Luna moths? A Luna moth? Okay. Check it out.
Okay.
All right. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about, since this is called Critic's Choice, I wanted us all to talk a little bit about the idea of finishing your book, and then it goes into the world, and then it gets reviews. Before there are readers, usually there are reviews. So I kind of wanted each of them, you know, being on the other side and sometimes on both sides, I wanted to hear each tell about the experience of getting that first review of a first book. Jamel.
Yeah. Well, the entire thing is terrifying, right? You spend so much time with this book, and it's such a big part of your life, and then it goes out, and it feels all of a sudden like it's ripped away from you, and it's not yours anymore, even though you still have this attachment to it. So it's terrifying. You don't know how people are going to respond. Other than the pre-publication reviews, so Publishers Weekly and things like that, I believe my first review was in the LA Times. Which ended up being really kind of special. It was reviewed by a graphic memoirist named Kristen Radke. So she not only reviewed the book with her word, she also made art from the book. And, you know, the words in the review were positive, so that felt great. But the thing that made it really special to me, I think, is that she took the time to share her imagination of my characters, you know, to show sort of her level of involvement with the book, that she could depict what they look like in her mind, scenes from the book. And that was really special, you know, to sort of see that and see the ways in which it resembled what I had in mind, to see the ways in which she sort of infused it with her own readerly imagination. So that was really great, and I was super grateful for it.
Did it kind of open the pathway for you to see that you were gonna, your book was gonna change depending on whoever read it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've always believed in the idea of an active reader. I want active readers. I don't want to sort of bowl my readers over with the message of the book or anything like that. So it was nice to sort of see that creative readership at play in a review. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really nice.
I think that's fascinating that they would make that choice. Was Carolyn Kellogg the editor at that point, do you know?
I think so.
Okay. Because I was going to say, we've been talking a lot of late in the book critics world, especially among people in the National Book Critics Circle, and we at our more recent board meeting about some of the limitations on book pages around the country that are going on, and the focus on the idea of clicks and how important clicks are. And I was on a panel at AWP, and I said, clicks don't equal conversation. You might read this and then talk to all kinds of people. It's not part of the surveillance. It's not part of the, you know, the click technology, but it's valuable. And can you imagine the idea that having a graphic novelist review book is going to bring a lot of interest in many ways? So I think that's a very creative choice that she made,
yeah.
Which is part of that world of critics' choice and the book editor's choice. Reese, tell us about that first review. Were you ready? Were you given warnings?
Well, so the very first thing anyone wrote about my book, I think, was your write-up, Jane, in the BBC Most Anticipated 2019 Books.
Oh my God!
Because I was looking.
I'm glad I liked it.
And I loved what you said about it, and I loved that it was part of that. That list was amazing, and that meant so much to me. Because that came out in like January, or
yeah, it came out in January.
Yeah, so that was 6+ months before my book came out. So that was the first thing I heard about it. So thank you.
I'm glad it turned out so well. It'd be awkward, you know. Very Oops. How about you then, Molly?
There's so many different kinds of reviews. You know, there's Goodreads reviews, there's Amazon reviews, there's pre-publication reviews, which are anonymous. And then there's the newspaper reviews and journalistic reviews, even online venues. They all have a different kind of relationship to the book. So I'm not sure which was the first. But what I'll say is that what I've learned, and I'm really glad that my book is coming out after I have some experience as myself, a film reviewer. I write film reviews for the New York Review of Books. And I'm coming from a tradition of being a literary critic and an academic. And you don't do the thumbs up, thumbs down in literary criticism. Like, it's called criticism, but it's not about, it's supposed to be as neutral as possible. Perhaps a withering tone, but. So, you know, I would write these, I've been writing these essay-like things, and it's been really funny for me to see, Rotten Tomatoes says that all of my reviews are fresh, but the quotes are always like completely neutral, that they take the pull quotes that they put on Rotten Tomatoes. And I think having this sense that, to quote the Susan Sontag bot that I follow on Twitter. It's like a diary entry. She said, before is it good, what is it? And that's been a kind of lodestone for me as a writer of these reviews. So reading reviews of my own work, my attention is, did they figure out what it is, or did they tell me something new about what it is, or did they just do thumbs up, thumbs down? Right. And sometimes those are in combination. But for me, regardless of the flattery, I've learned that words of praise is not one of my love languages. I don't really like I'm much more interested in like material gifts and to engage with my work in a serious way, regardless of whether you call it dazzling or absurd or, you know, wonderful or what else have I been called? Flat character, I think, was one negative thing said in a review. Glib, that's another one. Regardless of what the person says, positive or negative, how engaged were they with the actual book? Like, did they tell me something? So the guy who called my book glib, I was like, but he got the like mosquito philosophy better than any other reviewer. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yes. Do you guys have any questions for each other? I always think it's a great opportunity. You get these, I mean, you know, three writers in a room. Thoughts?
I'll ask a question of both of you, which is, what was the best part of your editorial experience?
So with my editor, I worked on the book for a year and a half. So we sold it at around the 8.5 year mark. And then we worked on it together for a year and a half where she would have thoughts and questions and edits. We went through, I think, three rounds before it went off to copy edits. And it turned out, I love her so much. I would love to work with her again. In my editor at Riverhead, Laura, I found someone who cares as much about punctuation as I do. And I care desperately about words. I care desperately about syllables. I love punctuation. I can just like space out staring at the M dash being like, God, you're beautiful. Like there's so much you can do. It's so versatile. And with this book, it turned out, so I love the M dash, but I use very few M dashes. I favor semicolons and colons. And we had an entire editorial round that basically consisted of my editor saying, can this semicolon be cut? And I would think there's just no way. If we change that semicolon to a colon, like the entire book, it's going to fall apart. Like there's no, it's the entire precipice will fall apart if we change this one punctuation mark. So then we talk and it'd be, well, could it be a period? And I never agreed to a single change that I didn't believe in myself. But you know, there were changes that were made. And so we would talk and say, well, maybe it could be a period. Well, would a period be stronger here than a semicolon? And I'll give you the measure of how many edits, of how much we did this kind of back and forth. Every time I did not take an edit of hers, she asked me to explain why in the comments, which I was happy to do. So by the end of what's like a relatively quite short novel, it shakes out to just a little over 200 pages. By the end, and this is when I didn't take a suggested edit, we had over 1,000 comments in the manuscript with back and forth about it. And at some point she was like, Reese, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about your semicolons. and I was like, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about the semicolons. And so, it was so delightful to meet someone, to come across someone who cares as much as I do. And
cool. So I had two editors at Grey Wolf, which I didn't quite know going in, and it was a little bit of a surprise that I'd be working with two different people. And initially I had some concerns, like, are they going to be telling me different things? Am I going to be getting mixed messages? But it actually worked out really well. So two editors, four rounds of edits, one with one editor, two with another editor, and then a final round with both of them. And it worked beautifully, to my surprise a little bit. There were a few things that I really loved about the process of working with them. First of all, they're both great editors, Fiona McRae and Steve Woodward at Grey Wolf. And I felt like they trusted me. Many of their editorial comments were questions. And questions of the variety that invited me to sort of dive back into the work and explore it further, which is great. Another thing that was great is that they kind of both share kind of the old school album concept of a story collection that I do, meaning that you know, some story collections are just sort of like, here's some stories I wrote in the last few years. Whereas I wanted my collection to have kind of the cohesion and the sense of a journey that kind of like classic albums have, you know? And that if you read the book from beginning to end, it takes you on a particular kind of journey. And so it was a lot of fun to work with them. I mean, often we worked in person. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time, and Grey Wolf was in Minneapolis. So two times we actually like met in person, which was a lot of fun. So we could have the stories right in front of us on a table and kind of do this work. But you know, one thing that we did was work a lot on story order, which I didn't really think about that much before the book was submitted. But what does it mean that the book starts with that house party? You know, what does it mean that it ends with the story that it does? You know, where do those starting and ending places, you know, how do they echo with each other? And how do the ends of stories sort of embrace or you know, sort of exist in friction, productive friction with the beginning of a subsequent story? You know, those kinds of things, questions that became really important, and how certain sentences in one story could be kind of teased out in order to point to a story to come or a story that, you know, was a couple stories back. So that process was a lot of fun for me. How about you?
I didn't know I'd have to answer my own question. I also had two editors, a British and an American editor, because it was a US-UK imprint, Hogarth. And it was very fun to bounce them off of each other in terms of their different personalities. One, for example, the mosquito swarm narration was an idea I brought to them after I'd sold the book. And I was like, I have this idea. And my American editor was like, great, go for it. And my British editor was like, I don't know about this no more. And that sort of like carried through for the voice that I used for early rounds of that voice, where my American editor was like, yes, more annoying. Yes, make it as annoying as a real mosquito. And my British editor was like, this is really irritating. You really must change this. And so, you know, figuring out the voice, but then also how often they would come in and for how long, it ended up being a really nice kind of compromise negotiation type of deal. And now we have just like running jokes about my Moz, as I call them, my M-O-Z. We didn't ever get down to the level of punctuation. The book was too long, I think, for real line edits. So, but I will say, I have a lot of metaphors and similes, figures that liken punctuation to bugs.
Wonderful. You know, it's gone so fast. I have more questions, but I'll bet the audience might have some too. So, anyone want to ask a question? If not, we have more to say. I see one over here. Mike will come to you.
Whoa. Hi. I would love to hear what you guys' writing process looks like. Just small details, like, you know, would you like to work, you know, in a crowded cafe or at home alone or in the morning, late night? It's just kind of cool to know.
What's the writing process like for you guys?
Well, just as if you're interested in that sort of thing, I would highly recommend a book called Daily Rituals, which talks about that particular type of thing for Flaubert and Einstein and just a whole bunch of different people. And the only commonalities are people like walks and they like some form of stimulant, be it caffeine or cocaine. I personally can write anywhere that I have sunlight. I like ambient noise. I write in the afternoons when I'm sleepy.
I actually really like to write at the minute, as soon as I can, when I can, I write after I get up in the morning, because I like to go as fast as I can from that sort of dream state to my work. And that helps me, because for me at least, no matter what the previous writing day was like, if it was a bad day, then of course I'm going to be afraid to get back into the writing. If it was a good day, it's even scarier, because I know if it was a good day, the second day is not going to be as good. And I'm probably going to delete most of what I wrote the previous day. And so to just sort of evade that terror, it's useful for me to just like jump as fast as I can into the writing. I actually have I need to write in a room with no light, with blackout shades. I have nothing on the walls. We used to have like paintings and pictures up on the walls, and I realize like they all just distract me, and I want to have my room, I want to have my apartment look as sort of like nun cell like as possible, so that I can hang out in my head and not get distracted by everything around me. One of the most controversial essays I've ever written, and I've written some fairly controversial essays about race and gender, but the one that got the most trolls in my mentions was a piece I wrote about how for years I kept my books spine in because I found them so distracting. They shout, the title shout at you. And and I knew exactly where they were because I knew them by their backsides, which in a way felt so intimate to me. Like I was the only one who could find them. It felt like in the Odyssey when the nurse recognizes him by like a mole. I'm like the nurse, and and my books are him. So I have as little stimulation as possible.
I've become a little bit less precious about this, you know, after the past year of kind of traveling for events and dealing with airplanes and hotels and things like that. But ideally, I'm also a morning writer, and, you know, at home. I can't be at like the cafe where people are doing things. I don't want to see you do things. I need to be at home at my desk with my coffee cup and my own kind of grossness. Like that's how I want to write. And you know, I know some writers don't like to, they feel like having, the words of other writers around them is kind of contaminating. I actually find it inspiring. And often I'm writing stories that in some way are in conversation with other stories. So I actually do like to have, a book, you know, a story collection or a novel or a poetry collection next to me, like something I can just sort of dip into some language, and usually just a couple of sentences is enough to get me going. But I like to have words, not people.
Another question. You and then you.
Okay.
And then I think that's going to be it.
Wow. Okay.
Reese, I was really interested in what you said about loneliness in terms of that you went to literature and you didn't find that story of that isolation you felt after you left your church or your faith was changed. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how in the writing that did you feel more of a kinship then through your own exploration of that? I'm just curious about what that was like.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. In a lot of ways, because people have often asked, like, how did you stay with the book for 10 years? And for me, often when I felt really discouraged or when I wonder, like, what am I doing with my life? Why didn't I become a dermatologist?
I'd have been a great dermatologist. I love thinking about skincare. So that sort of that suitcase of thoughts would just hit me. But it really helped to think about that 17-year-old girl who felt alone in the world. And I would just keep thinking, I want to write a book for people who feel this way, to let them know that they're not alone and they were never alone. And so it's been incredibly meaningful to travel with this book and to hear from, it's always meaningful to hear from readers, but it's so meaningful to hear from people who say, I was an ex-Jehovah's Witness. I myself have been in a cult, or I grew up really Christian and I'm not. This book did help me feel less lonely. And I'm always just that's just instant tears for me. I'll always cry if someone says that, but.
This is for Namwali.
Mm-hmm.
Your world is so amazing. I mean, there's this, and I guess I'm curious about how it became that world. And did you know when you started out it was going to span so many generations? And it's just, I'm just in awe.
Thank you so much. readers often ask me how I come up with ideas, and I don't know, and I think if I did know, I would probably do it more and make money. And I also think if I were to know how, maybe the magic would go away. But I will say the book came to me multi-generational and multi-genre. I imagined one family, the Black Zambian family, Martha, Sylvia, her daughter, and Jacob. They came at once in the year 2000. I was writing them. And I remember Martha has her heart broken and starts to cry. And she cries so much that her eyes kind of congeal shut and her lashes sew her eyes closed. The salt chokes her throat. And she cries for decades. And so it's this kind of magical realist trope. I was very interested in magical realism when I started writing the book. Then her daughter, in response to this, is basically I'm never going to fall in love. She refuses it. And of course, then she falls in love. And her son, Jacob, suffers this kind of abandonment. So there was always this relationship between the generations. And Jacob was always obsessed with airplanes. Over the course of 3 or 4 years became an obsession with technology in general. And so I knew it was science fiction. But when I presented these three characters in a workshop as an undergraduate, the other readers in the class were very confused. They were like, why doesn't the daughter also have magical elements? And why is the grandson sort of science fictional? And isn't this in Africa? Why is there science anyway? And they were confused that there were Coke bottles, Coca-Cola bottles. I was like, okay. Don't you know it's an international capitalist? No, anyway. That was the year 2000, right? In the year 2004, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas came out. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde came out a few years after that. Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. So suddenly all of these other writers were playing with genre in a way that was really resonant with what my original impulse had been. And even, White Teeth was a big inspiration for the book. Two families, multicultural, a very cosmopolitan London. I wanted that for Lusaka because no one understands African cities to have that cosmopolitanism built in. But that was my experience growing up there. I wanted three families because I wanted the relationship to be less Montague Capulet and more oblique cycle. So that immediately expanded the multiculturalism. And in retrospect, when I revisited White Teeth to teach it, I realized that that book is multi-genre too, actually. People don't think of it that way. They think of it just as kind of Dickensian realism. But there are historical moments, and there's Future Mouse, which is this genetic near future science fictional element as well. So I was clearly, I think, inspired by something in the water in the 2000s that eventually culminated in this multiverse of my book. I hope that helps.
Thank you all. The time is up. I can't believe it. This went so fast. You guys were great. There are books. There are books. There are books for sale. There are books for sale. And all of these folks are also writing on new work that you should be looking for soon. So follow these books, and if you love them, look for more. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.